want to know how you chose this repertory.
You know, these are very troubled and troubling times, and I thought those two Bach pieces offered us a kind of tranquility and a kind of peace that I certainly could use, and I thought that perhaps any number of us out in the world might appreciate. So I chose those with care and with intent aforehand.
You accomplished that with this listener.
I'm glad.
There's a real spiritual component to really the whole recording, but certainly the first two Bach pieces.
Well, that was really purposeful, and I'm delighted that it succeeded.
Since I host a Baroque and early music program, I can't let that opportunity pass to ask you about Bach. A lot of performers express having a particular and special relationship with Bach's music, and I'm curious to know about your feelings about that.
Well, in a way, I played comparatively little Bach because it was almost too much of a challenge for me, in the sense that it seemed that there were so many possibilities available in approach that I really couldn't pick one. But on the other hand, these two pieces, as I said, speak to me in a way that is terribly important. And the in a sense, the lack of what you might call soap opera drama or imagery, it is so abstract. You know, Bach works it all the time. I mean, Bach is as successful on the kazoo as he is on the viola d'amore or the viola da gamba, because of this incredible abstraction. These lines that go in and out and intertwine and it's enormously satisfying music, I think. But difficult, especially on our instruments today, to play well. You know, I followed in a sense in the steps of my sainted teacher Schnabel, who never played transcriptions. I never played transcriptions. The first transcription I ever played was the Chaconne of Bach, transcribed by Brahms, which he did for Clara after she hurt her right hand one day, and he wanted to give her something to do with just the one hand. So that was the first one I've ever played. I usually detest transcriptions. The Brahms is not a transcription even. It's the wrong word. It's the wrong name, because he doesn't change a note. He doesn't add a note. He doesn't take away a note. It is note for note the original Bach and nothing but the Bach. The only change he makes is that he puts it an octave lower. So, and then these two tunes were just so irresistible, these two airs from these different cantatas, that these are the only transcriptions I play. I don't play any others.
So what, other than troubled times, what else goes into the process of choosing repertory for either a CD or for a performance?
Oh, I think it's really very simple. They're just pieces that one loves. One, you know, at different points in your life, you have different favorites. And at this point in my life, these are among them. The Chopin Nocturne it's really almost banal. I chose it because it was my mom's favorite piece. She was Polish, and she loved this nocturne in particular. And then to go with that, you know, after having chosen a Polish night piece, I thought it might be nice to have a French night piece like the Clair de Lune. They're matching keys. And the choice of the Schubert Sonata was kind of inevitable. It's one of my favorites of all time, and I just was in the mood to play it and or record it.
You've touched on another question I wanted to ask you about, and that's sort of going back to the beginning. I'd like to know when and how the passion for music was ignited in you.
I have an older brother, 5.5 years older, and he was taking piano lessons. I remember he must have been about 9. This was in San Francisco. We had an upright piano, and though my parents were not musical, either of them, they were drawn to the finer things in life, and they thought that he should be able to play the piano. What I remember rather clearly is that he would have his lessons. You know, in those days, the teacher came to the home, just like the doctor used to come to the home in those days. The teacher would come, my brother would have his lesson, and I remember sitting kind of quietly in the corner and watching, and when the lesson was over, my brother bounded out of the house and went to the playground. And I'm told that I went to the piano and reproduced what the teacher had asked of my brother, apparently even, better than he did. So when he got involved in school and could no longer take lessons, I took over those lessons for him. And it seemed to be a very fortuitous choice.
I understand that you have a pretty special connection with Rachmaninoff.
Wow. That came not only from left field, from the Ural Mountains. How so? Well, yes. I do remember, yes. He came. I'm from San Francisco, and he came to San Francisco to the War Memorial Opera House, I remember, and gave a recital there. I couldn't have been more than 5 or 6, and my mother took me. I remember we sat way in the balcony. He was a very tall man, but he looked tiny from up there. And at the end of the program, he was one who gave many, many encores. And during, I guess it was the second, third encore, something like that, my mom grabbed me by the hand, and I don't know how she knew her way backstage, but she found her way backstage so that we were in the wings as Rachmaninoff would come off stage, go back on, play another encore, come off. I've learned since that he knew how to control that whole process very well, because people just kept applauding until he would play the C-sharp minor prelude. Once he'd play that, it was over. That was the end. So the fact that he kept postponing the C-sharp minor prelude and played other things meant that he was willing to continue with this dance, this charade. Anyway, after about the 5th or 6th encore, he noticed me standing there, hanging onto my mother's hand. And he approached me. Tall, tall, tall man. And he peered down at this little boy. And he said, "You pianist?" And I remember I'm looking straight up at him, like the Empire State Building. I managed to nod my head. And he shook his head slowly and said, "Bad business, bad business." I've never forgotten that. He was so right.
Oh, that's great. you know, for some people, it would be a very awkward topic to discuss this dystonia that you have experienced, and yet you really seem to want not only to not hide, but to really talk very, very frankly about this.
No, I think it's very important to talk about it and get it out there. It's a serious thing. Mm-hmm. It afflicts some 10,000 musicians worldwide, and many of them don't want to talk about it. They have no recourse because if it gets out that they're not playing well or their chops are deficient, as it were, they'll lose their jobs. Mm-hmm. It's terribly important that this come to the fore and to the awareness of the medical community. It is a vastly misdiagnosed syndrome, and unknown to a great number of doctors. And at this point in my life, I'm delighted to have the responsibility. The Dystonia Medical Research Foundation, which is the umbrella organization for musicians with dystonia, which is of which group I am a board member. I go around the world for this group, and I address medical conventions to bring awareness to the medical community of dystonia, as well as addressing teachers and students themselves. So, yes, I'm delighted that you point this up.
What exactly is it for those who don't know, who've not heard of this, or who don't know, or may even think they might be experiencing it?
It could be. It is a neurological movement disorder, and it is the third most, popular, prevalent disorder. First is Parkinson's, and then comes a category called essential tremors, and dystonia is the third most prevalent neurological movement disorder. There's some 300,000 people in this country alone who suffer from dystonia, and the signs of it are an uncontrollable and an involuntary cramping, contracting of certain muscles anywhere in the body, be it around the eyes, the mouth, the hands, the finger, the leg, anywhere.
And I understand that you have found successful treatment in Botox. Is that true?
Yes, believe it or not. Botox.
How does that help?
Well, they have discovered, and this was some 15 years ago, they started a clinical program at National Institutes of Health here in Bethesda, Maryland. They have discovered that the injection of a minute amount of botulinum toxin type A, which is Botox, injected into the spot where the nerve tells the muscle to contract, results in the Botox erecting a sort of barrier so that message doesn't get through from the nerve to the muscle, and the muscles remain normally extended.
And how long have you been yourself getting this treatment?
For some 8 years now, every 6 months or so. The shot lasts anywhere from 5 to 7 months. So on the average of every 6 months, I get my Botox injection in my arm. I have the smoothest, most unwrinkled arms you've ever seen.
Oh. Now, for a long time, you know, your reputation and your career was really focused on playing one-hand piano music. And folks who don't play piano may sort of wonder, well, how can a pianist do that? How can a pianist manage successfully using just one hand as you've done for so long? Could you sort of explain that?
Yeah, well, there is special music written for one hand. Most of the concerto repertoire, meaning for solo piano, left hand, and orchestra, is thanks to a terrible accident suffered by an Austrian pianist in World War I who had his right arm shot off. His name was Paul Wittgenstein. And thank goodness he was of a very well-to-do family, because he immediately commissioned composers of his day, which are, you know, like old classical composers to us today, meaning people like Maurice Ravel, Prokofiev, Britten, Richard Strauss, Korngold, people like that. They all wrote concertos for Mr. Wittgenstein, meaning concertos that wrote original music for left hand and orchestra.
Some 40 years ago or so, when you first began having this problem, this really changed your plans. This really changed your career and really changed your life. But I'm wondering now, in hindsight, do you think that in any way maybe this was sort of a blessing in disguise?
Oh, yes. Yes, I think you... You pinpoint something in my life that's very important, if not crucial. And that is that for all the great experiences that I've had since contracting dystonia, and all the expansion thereof of my musical activities into a more concentrated teaching, looking into the left-hand literature, conducting, all of these things have afforded me the kinds of pleasures and satisfaction that I'm not at all sure I would have had I just continued as a even successful two-handed piano player. So my conclusion there is that even if I had it all to do over again, I am not at all sure but that I wouldn't just do the same thing.
I'll bet this has really affected the kind of teacher you are, too.
I think it probably has. I feel much more precise and successful in communicating things to my students as a result of this debility.
Can you tell me a little bit more detail about this initiative, Freedom to Play?
Well, that's this program that I just described to you that's sponsored by the DMRF, Dystonia Medical Research Foundation, and I've been going around the world. I've been addressing medical conferences. The last one I addressed was in Rome, and at the opening of the conference, the Pope had sent an emissary, wishing us well. You see, he himself suffers from a neurological movement disorder. It's called Parkinson's. Well, it's a different form. You know, it's another problem, but the same general family as dystonia.
What is next for you? Is there some music that you are really still yearning to play that you plan to tackle next?
Yes, certainly there's always, the literature is so vast that I'm enormously lucky to be able to look into it. However, I do have an immediate goal that is of interest. For many years there were rumors about that one of the composers that Mr. Wittgenstein, this Austrian pianist of whom I spoke earlier, had commissioned Paul Hindemith, the great German composer, to write him a piece, but nobody could ever find the music, so it was just that, a rumor. Well, 2 years ago, Mr. Wittgenstein's widow passed away, and the children came to her home, her farm in, I think it was in New Hope, Pennsylvania, and started unlocking closets and drawers and stuff like that, and lo and behold, there they found the Hindemith left-hand concerto that had never been played. And I will play the world premiere in December in Berlin with the Berlin Philharmonic and Sir Simon Rattle, December 9, 10, and 11.
This has been a very inspiring conversation.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it. Thanks very much.